doing? Comes up. Want you to see his name. Yeah, I had a whole lot of them lined up on my in YouTube, my search engine. And when I want to find them, all of a sudden I can't. My goodness. Oh well. We'll find them. And I'm pretty sure I did the spelling right. Veritasium. Derek is the guy's first name. The main illustrator, Derek. I think it's Derek Mueller. He was born and brought up in Vancouver, British Columbia. He spends a lot of time in Australia. An awful lot of his programs come from Australia. And so the Down Under people have got fairly similar science understanding to the people in the United States and Europe, as I see it. One of the places he went to, I think it's in Vancouver, they've got this 2.5-ton globe made out of granite that looks to me like it's about 4 feet in diameter. And it's suspended on a water suspension system, a powered water suspension system. So it's got a very low friction to it. And you can push it and rotate it. And it's got a map of the world superimposed on this granite. And it really gives you a beautiful demonstration of inertia. A lot of people have a lot of trouble describing what inertia is. And when you push on something, F equals MA and how you build up momentum, a lot of people have a lot of trouble with that one, explaining it. And they don't have quite the right vocabulary and don't have quite the correct understanding of where the speed of something comes from. You have to make an investment. You have to apply a force for a given length of time to a given mass in order to create a certain amount of acceleration, in order to create a certain amount of accumulated velocity or momentum. Okay, anyone else listening to all of this jazz? If you've got something you want to add or subtract, or you've got further questions, give me a call. That is right now. This is you're listening to the tail end of TechNet number 1523. K2LIW listening.
That's actually
it. Go ahead, Wes.
Hey, Paul was mentioning nuclear battery. I wonder if you could say something about it, and I could have a few information as well.
Yeah, I think you're describing the RTG. So give us some words on the RTG. My understanding is that you've got plutonium continuously giving off particles that are being absorbed. The particles absorbed create heat. The heat goes to thermocouples. The thermocouples have got heat on the nuclear side and a heat sink on the cold side. The temperature difference on these thermocouples or Peltier-like devices generate electrical power. Is that approximately what an RTG is, Paul? Pretty sure you're more familiar with it than I am. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, next time you look at Curiosity, in the back, that back piece sticking out on it, it's probably about a 25-degree angle coming up from the back. That's where it's located. And that's plutonium-239. And like you said, it radiates out, just automatically gives off radiation as it, and if you cover it with graphite blankets, for instance, anything in that area will start to get hot and hotter and hotter. And in the case of Curiosity, for instance, you get up to temperature-wise, the equivalent of, I think, 1400 to 1500 watts. Then there's about 200 watts that actually get converted into about 140, I think 140, 130 for Curiosity, into electricity, and that charges two 40 amp hour lithium ion batteries. I'm dropping the heat. The only difference is I don't think there's any Peltier things going on with this. They're truly thermo operated hot water heater. You have a little thermocouple in there, comes out usually with, I think, 30 millivolts or something, which operates usually a small electric magnet that is pulling on a valve, and those things tend to go, and the guy has to come and change it to $60, you know, and pulls it out, unscrews one screw, and puts another one in, screws it back into the gas valve. In case the flame goes out, the valve closes. So those hold on one sec, let me drop it. Those are hooked into series with one another, and then you put it up and together, you hook them in parallel, and eventually you're going to get the wattage out of it that you need. You're going to get the proper voltage out of it. Most of these electronic stuff that's in deep space is all operating on 28 volts. That's the standard system that they use. So radioisotope, that's your plutonium. Thermo, that's your little dissimilar metals, like Dick said, creating the electricity, electric generator, and then you hooked up to a bunch of batteries, and you're good to go for years and years and years. In the case of Voyager, 34, 35 years, Dick, back to you.
What's for me to read? Oh, for you.
Yeah, that sure is nice. All those years. And so, in the case of Voyager, it's down to what, like a one third of the original power after 35 years, 37 years, something like that, Paul?
I think so. They're losing 4% every year. And is that what you were after, Wesley?
The question is much more wider because we've seen the existing out. Better voltaics, we might have a thermal, non-thermal conversion, so that would be, unlike most of the nuclear power sources which use nuclear radiation to generate heat, which then is used to generate electricity, the thermoelectric or thermonic sources of better voltaic use non-thermal conversion process, converting a electro-hole pairs produced by ionization trail of beta particles, Travis semiconductor, but the one that is used by NASA, I believe it was Advanced Stirling Radioisotope Generator ASRG, and that one was heat conversion, so it was Stirling power motor conversion technology that converts radioactive decay heat into the electricity by first utilizing the heat and to exchange.
The Stirling motor system? I think that's what he said. Dick, let me answer that. Stirling motor is actually a proposed, I mean, this is a far out proposal, but eventually they would like to land a rover on Venus. But the problem with Venus is, of course, it's 900 degrees, and they always want to try to see how long it's going to last. I mean, the Russians have done it a number of times, I think 8 or 9 times. We did it once, and the probes don't last long, you know. They would like to take the Stirling generators, operate on heat, and take the output of that to keep the these rovers cool. But they're long-term plans, you know, way out there, maybe. Who knows when? Probably won't live to see it, but they'd like to eventually use that system to power stuff for a rover from Venus. Dick, over to you.
One more question.
Go ahead, Wes.
Is it heat conversion in nuclear process necessary? Because we're dealing with the extremely low temperature. So anything above that temperature is already something that gives us significant effect. Now, with no heat conversion, You know that a single gram of polonium 210 generates 140 watts of power. Just 1 milligram. I'm sorry, 1 gram. So because it emits alpha particles, which are stopped with very short distance in dense media, and thus it releases its energy, polonium 210 was used as the lightweight heat source to power thermoelectric cells in satellites. Question is, was it ever used without the heat conversion? And to explain.
They just use the system because they need the heat. They actually need the heat. The 1400 watts I was talking about before, I mean, they utilize that to keep the circuits and everything nice and toasty up there. If they were just going to just convert it, you know, to use for electricity, maybe they might go with another system. But they actually need that heat. They have it in the central part of the robes, all the robes, they're called the warm electronic boxes, and they need to keep those things warm. And in the case of the Curiosity and Spirit, they have, and even the other one, the Pathfinder, they have little charges of plutonium that are just used to keep things warm, keep the body warm. So it's a their solar panel vehicles, those three that I mentioned. They need the heat of these plutonium battery looking. They look like D-cell batteries. If you look at them, they're all lined up. Dick, what do you
One more question. A polonium emitter, let's say 210, has only the half-life of 138 days. 138.376 days. And it decays to 206, it decays to what? Anyhow, question is, if they were using it in robots and there was alpha emitter, that means that the lifespan of such a battery was an extremely short one.
But that's no good.
Now, Paul, in the case of the plutonium that's used on Curiosity, for instance, you gave us the isotope number. Give me that isotope number again. And of the nuclear energy it radiates, that gets absorbed by the carbon blanket, if I understand correctly, gets turned into heat. The nuclear radiation coming off, I should know and I don't. Is that alpha, beta, gamma, or some combination? What is the actual nature, and what is the isotope number? WS2N, K2RIW?
I know it's plutonium-239. I always thought it was the alpha rays, but I might be wrong. But they're coming off, hitting the blanket, and that's it. And, it's insulated by the blanket in that whole area. Yeah, that gets very hot, and that's where they put these thermocouples.
Plutonium 239. What's the approximate half life on that one, Paul?
I thought it was 84 years, but I'd have to check. It beats out 210 or whatever Wesley said was. 100 and some odd days. We need years. That's the problem.
Dick, I think it's 32,000 year half life on 239.
10 years, Dick.
Yeah, John just said he thinks it's 32,000 years for plutonium 239. That strikes me as a little bit long, but whatever it is, even if it's only 84 years, and it's probably the exact same one that was used on Voyager. So Voyager, after 37 years, down to a fraction of the power, I'm guessing it's not because of the plutonium degradation. I'm guessing it's because of the degradation of the thermocouples. Is that a good guess, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
sounds what they say, but just, you know, they're not as effective. The thermocouples, I don't know what happens. If some of them fail or they have a way around it to keep up the voltage, I have no idea. I tried to look, try to find out one time how many thermocouples were actually involved, you know. And I couldn't figure that out, but there must be hundreds of them. So, in a probably very small package, all wired together. I envision all these things, you know, packed inside of it, something about the size of a brick, you know, with a million wires coming off it, all tied together. But I have no idea, Dick. Back to you.
24,360 years, I found. Well, each of those RTGs have an outer case that I'm guessing is a medium good shield, so that the nuclear radiation coming off the plutonium-239, essentially none of it is getting to the rest of the electronics, is my guess. Is that approximately true, Paul?
Yeah, that's why a lot of these, like you see the spacecraft with these big long arms, and with Curiosity, it's at the tail end of the thing, and they have it sticking furthest away, because, you know, yeah, it could be a problem. You know, they don't want it near any of the detectors, so even like Cassini, look at a picture of Cassini, it's always long arms extending away from it. You know, they don't want any interference from the RTGs. And there's usually, three of these things on Voyager, on each one. I guess if one failed, the other two would keep going or something. And they're very redundant, crazy.
Do you believe the triple RTGs on Voyager was done more for redundancy and safety of power as opposed to just a method of generating enough simultaneous power? Is that a good guess?
Yeah, that's what I always thought. I mean, I know they need the heat to keep things warm, but, it does work like that, but, you know, they needed backup, you know. They wanted to make sure that they got to the outer planets. You know, that was the goal, you know. Everything else, this heliopause and everything, this is all gravy.
In the case of Voyager, where the RTG is on a very long arm to protect the rest of the electronics, and yet they need the heat coming off that RTG, how is the heat on that very long arm being coupled back to the electronics? Because where Voyager is sitting right now, it's in a part of space that's running around 3 degrees Kelvin. That's extremely cold. So how are they coupling the heat on that very long arm from the RTG back to the electronics that must be kept toasty? Over you, Paul.
Yeah, well, I mean, it looks like it's only like a foot away. I mean, it's not a long arm. The RTG is not completely far away from the main body, but some of the equipment, the sensing equipment, you can see they have these long arms coming out of it. Something would be affected. I think they had a neutron detector or something, so they, whatever detectors that they had were on these, you know, 10-foot arms, you know, to keep it away from the RTGs.
Is it possible that there's a heat pipe between the RTG and the chunk of electronics that's got to be kept toasty, in which case you only have to transport a gas in the heat pipe, and the conversion of the gas, evaporating it on one end and condensing it on the other end, gives you the heat flow. Is that possibly what they're doing, Paul?
I thought they had like a channel and it was metal, you know, just a conduction type of thing. But I know that's the way it is in the on the rovers. They went through these elaborate procedures on the rovers to keep everything warm. You know, they didn't even want the cold coming in into the wires and into the box. So the wires would come in at the far end of it, and it would go down this tunnel. And by the time it got to the inside part, the wires were warmed up already. I mean, That's why they call it the warm electronic box. Everything going in and out is going completely away from whatever they were trying to keep warm. Pretty elaborate. But I've never seen a close-up. I mean, I've seen a lot of close-up pictures of Voyager and, you know, cutaway diagrams, but never like any real exploded views where you could really get into it. I've never seen anything like that. Well, you know, not for lack of trying, Dick.
If you're looking at a picture of a pipe that looks like it's a thermal conductor coupling the heat from the RTG over to the toasty electronics, there's one particular design of a heat pipe that on the outside looks like a large diameter copper pipe. Inside it's hollow with a wick, and the fluid is flowing back and forth between the two ends. And a well-designed heat pipe, I think, can conduct thermal energy something like 10 times or 100 times greater than a solid chunk of copper. It's extremely efficient. So what looks like a solid copper rod in the pictures you've seen, Paul, might possibly really be a hollow heat pipe with a wick inside. Go ahead, KQLIW.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, you know, similar way our gravity heating system would work in a house, you know, not so much gravity, but, you know, the condensation flow of heat, you know, in a solid, it's going to move along that solid, and it's going to get out somewhere. It's going to head to the coolest spot. So if they have it directed towards some of the electronics, I guess that's how they're doing it. But I'm not envisioning. I don't think they have glycol on board and pumps and all of that. Of course, it's got to be done with something very simple to transfer the heat. On the International Space Station, you got pumps and ammonias, pumps pumping ammonia, radiators, you know, all kinds of elaborate systems to actually get rid of the heat inside the space station. But not for these spacecraft. It's got to be similar to what you said, Dick. Well, I can't say 100%, but that's a good guess.
When you Google the word Veritasium, you might come up with the word, his name, Derek Muller, M-U-L-L-E-R. And it says here that Muller created the popular YouTube channel called Veritasium in January of 2011. It has 188 video uploads. He has 1,700,000 subscribers, and they have viewed his material 92.9 million times as of August 8th of 2014. He's a popular guy. So this Veritasium, when it comes to science videos, you're going to like it, Paul. Go ahead.
If he's not a ham, I'm not going to watch it. No, just kidding, Dick. Back to you.
Yeah, go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, talking about low temperatures, eventually lightsabers for astronauts to fight with themselves. team of Harvard, Massachusetts, and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, they found the way to create new form of matter, let's say. I discussed that with Roy already. They were able to coax photons into binding together to form molecules. So we're talking about photons. Photons don't have a mass. Let me jump. So it's a state of matter that until recently was just theoretical, and it's dated at 25th of September 2013. They say that they have done it this way, that they create a special type of medium in which photons interact with each other so strongly that they begin to act as they have a mass, and they bind together to form molecules. And this type of photonic bound state has been discussed theoretically for quite a while, but they were able to observe it. So what did he do? They pump rubinium atoms into the vacuum chamber. So in space we have vacuum. Then they use lasers to cool the cloud of atoms to just a few degrees above absolute zero. And Roy was kind enough, and you've got that email as well, he actually explained how the laser cooling is being done. So using extremely weak pulses, they have fired single photons into the cloud atom. So when the photons enter the clouds of cold atoms, its energy excites atoms along its path, causing the photons to slow dramatically, and the photon moves through the cloud that the energy is handled off from atom to atom and eventually exits the cloud with the photon. Anyhow, it's interesting article, and if you have a time, because I discussed that with John before, and John would be able to say a few words as well, that Roy, the email is extremely helpful. And to you.
Maybe this coming week I'll be a little bit out from under a bunch of things that I was doing. I was very busy the last couple of weeks. John, you might want to give us some explanation about what Roy has recently communicated to you guys. Roy is an amazing guy. He's a physician by trade. My goodness, does he have a science background. Wow. Both at the subatomic level, the nuclear level, and so on. He's teaching us a lot of stuff by these emails he's sending us. An awful lot of people don't know that what we call temperature is average kinetic energy of molecules. That usually means translational speed. When something is hot that you measure with a temperature, with a thermometer, it's because those molecules are moving at a certain speed on average. And when you cool something, you're slowing them down. So by laser, I'm going to call it several mechanism-like techniques, you can take individual molecules and assume you can, in theory, make them stop moving entirely, make their temperature go to near zero. However, because of the laws of thermodynamics, you're never going to get to absolute zero in temperature, 0 degrees Kelvin, because I forget which one of the laws it is of thermodynamics, that the light, that the energy always flows downhill. Let me drop. Everything in this universe is hot by comparison to the cryogenic temperature of near 0 degrees Kelvin you're trying to achieve. No matter what you do, the best insulation, the best cooling techniques, there's always going to be heat pouring from the outside universe into your experiment. You may get down to millikelvins and microkelvins and nanokelvins of temperature. And one of these Veritasium articles, by the way, was when you achieve near absolute zero in temperature, do the electrons stop moving? And the answer is absolutely not. Those electrons, you wouldn't have an atom anymore if you didn't have a nucleus with the positive charge and the electrons with the negative charge as a cloud going around that nucleus. So cooling something to absolute zero is stopping its translational and rotational energy of the atom. It is not stopping the electron motion. Those electrons keep doing the exact same thing, regardless of the temperature of the atom itself, as I see it. So tell me what you've observed from Roy's latest emails on KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Dick, I really agree with you, I think, on the electrons. They're not stopping. I agree with that. Although I have not gotten into the discussion that Wesley is having with Roy, so I'll let you pick it up back with Wes. But yeah, I agree with that.
I can give you a quick explanation. Great. A laser photon hits the atom and causes it to emit photons of higher energy. Everything is due to conservation of the momentum. So, the photon is absorbed from the lasers, the energy difference comes from the thermal excitations within the atoms. And this heat from the thermal excitation is converted into light, which leaves the atom as photon. It is conservation of momentum, definitely it is. Atom is traveling towards the laser beam, and photon from laser beam is absorbed by the atom. And momentum of the atom is reduced by the amount of momentum of the photon that absorbs. But easy way, just easy way. Let's say you have a guy or the hovercraft moving in certain velocity in one direction. Heavy metallic balls are being thrown at you. You have this hover, right, from all of the directions, front, back, left, right. But you can only catch the balls that are coming from directly in front of you. So if you were to catch all of those balls, you would slow down due to the conservation of the momentum. And eventually, you must throw the ball away. But the direction in which you throw the ball away is completely random. And due to the conservation of the momentum, throwing the ball away will increase your velocity in the direction opposite to the ball. So you're going to be like a crazy guy inside the hover. Since the throwaway direction is random, the contribution to your velocity will vanish on average. So the forward velocity will decrease due to the preferentially catching the balls in front, and eventually your movements will entirely be dictated by the recoil effect of the catching and throwing the balls. And that would be sort of how it works. And to see it.
So the laser beam is used, I'm guessing it's focused on individual molecules by some form of sensing. You know the molecule is moving, we'll say, in the positive X direction, and you can fire a laser in such a direction that it stops or slows down the motion in the positive X direction. You are taking energy out of that molecule. You're cooling it by aiming that laser at it. Is that approximately what's happening, Wes? K2LAW?
Well, it would be definitely a law of the conservation of the momentum. And when the energy is absorbed by the laser, then the heat from the thermal excitation is converted to light. That's how you make a cooling. That's what I see.
One of these science videos, on a slightly related subject, one of these science videos I've seen in the last 24 hours talks about the antimatter that has been generated at CERN. CERN did manage to generate positrons, in other words, oppositely charged electrons, and also oppositely charged protons. And they managed to put them together as molecules, hydrogen molecules. And I think they did, in one experiment, collect something like 39 individual anti-hydrogen molecules, and they were able to confine them for 1/6 of a second before they struck the walls of the container and annihilated. Whenever antimatter hits matter, it gets converted into energy. So for 1/6 of a second, something like 39 molecules of antimatter was created at CERN and maintained. And so the implication is that they're working on techniques for generating more antimatter and confining it for a longer period of time. Although it's been used in Star Trek episodes of science fiction, that in theory a very high energy content fuel would be two separate containers side by side. One has got matter and one's got antimatter. And you allow them to mix together in the rocket engine at just the right rate, at just the right time. And that probably is one of the highest energy engines you could create, or the highest energy storage techniques, the highest storage of fuel energy, matter and antimatter. Wouldn't that be nice? What would you, Wes? N2XJN, K2LAW.
WS2N, a quick update on the Dawn spacecraft, the thrust.
Yeah, go ahead. What is the thrust? Is it a fraction of an ounce?
Yeah, quickly. One of the effects is Compton effects, although there are two mechanisms of that. It's a pet production and inhalation. So, the photo absorption, in process of which, photo gives up some of its energy to the material particle, and when they hit the solids, the photo absorption can be quantified in terms of absorption, I would say coefficient, and I mean the energy must come from somewhere, and the pair production would be matter and antimatter. There would be positron and electron. Those two tend to destroy themselves. And to achieve.
Sounds good. Were there a few grams of force that the ion engines gave out? Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, officially it was 91 millinewtons at maximum thrust. So that's all it is. So what would that be? Roughly one tenth of a newton, right? If it was 100 millinewtons, yeah, I guess that would be one tenth of a newton, or close to it. And they describe it as you take a piece of paper, you know, 8 by 11 piece of paper, put it in your hand, and that weight, that's the force that you would get. They gave you another example. Floating around in space, you turn the thing on, you're going to go from 0 to 60 in a whopping 4 days. It'll take you 4 days to get up to 60 miles per hour. But it never shuts off, so it goes for thousands of days. Back to you, Dick.
I'm about to convert 91 millinewtons into grams of force with my HP50G, and it says, how about that, 9 grams. 91 millinewtons is 9.28, let's call it, grams. So that's roughly a third of an ounce. Roughly a third of an ounce of force, 9 grams, from one single engine. Is that true, Paul?
Yes, but only one engine at a time. Then they give it a rest, that type of thing. They do have them kicked in a couple degrees off to one another, so they can actually use it to control its attitude in space a little bit as well. But yeah, that's pretty much it. I figure, let me jump in there in case anybody was listening. And they don't, it's not that easy to find on the net. I found it, my old notes. Back to you, Dick.
And by the way, those RTG-powered science experiments that were put on the surface of the moon by the Apollo astronauts, they're called ALSEP, A-L-S-E-P, Apollo Lunar Surface Experimental Packages. And they ran at roughly 2.1 gigahertz, 2.28, roughly 2.3 gigahertz downlink frequency. I personally, way back in 1971, listened to two of those spacecraft on the moon, listened to the downlink signal, the carrier of them, Paul, WS2N, K2RW, using that 12-foot dish that was in August 1972 QST magazine.
Okay, I remember that story. And then, they left the antenna on the moon surface. So, parabolic antenna facing Earth before they left. Hooked up to that thing. Very good. And then I think on the old missions with the rovers, they just left the rover with the antenna pointing toward Earth. This way they can pick up all the signs that way. In fact, that's how they watched the last one take off. They had the cameras pointing at the lemon, and the transmission was actually being done through the rover, through its parabolic beams.
Yeah, the rover vehicle, the moon car, The moon car had its own antenna and camera, and that was backed off to one side to watch the takeoff of Apollo 17 for sure, and probably some of the earlier ones. I think they first used the rover car on, was it Apollo 12 or Apollo 14 when they first used the rover car, Paul? K2LAW.
The last three missions, 15, 16, and 17. 14 had a little mailbag, you know, carrier, you know, on wheels that they would push along. That's what they used. That was Alan Shepard and who did he go up with? Was that Mitchell? And that's how they did it. 11 didn't have anything. 12 didn't have anything. 13 never got there. 14 had the mailbag system. And, 12, you know, you can't forget 12. 12 went over to the Surveyor spacecraft that had landed a couple of years earlier and took the camera back with them. Back to you, Dick.
As I remember, they carried a very fancy cutting tool which allowed them to cut the piece of tubing that the camera was mounted on. They probably left that tool there after they used it. That allowed them to disconnect the camera and bring it home. And by studying that camera, I guess they could find out something about what is a long-duration space exposure like when it comes to delicate chunks of electronics and the photosensitive surface inside the camera. Was that the main motivation of that operation, Nepal, K2LAW?
The science goal for bringing the camera back, I don't know. I know they wanted to bring the lens back or something there to see if there was any contamination or something. And they found out that they thought that bacteria could live all this time, you know, year, 2 years after Surveyor 6 had landed. And because they said, oh, there's bacteria on the lens or something. But then they realized that it was touched by somebody there, and they believed something for many years before they found out it wasn't true. Even after diagnosing everything, bringing it back. There's some controversy. That's always good reading.
I remember reading some of the NASA reports on, I guess it was the space shuttle landings. They would do a microscopic examination of the windshields on the shuttle, look for the tiny little pug marks, and from that they could find out what was the rate at which micrometeorites were hitting the windshield. So they did find tiny pock marks in the windshield when you do a microscopic inspection. I vaguely remember reading a couple of reports along those lines. Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
I saw the pock marks in windshields. You know, that every flight had that. But there was a bigger hole. Not that it went all the way through. You know, I think the glass was like 4 inches thick or something. But there was a chunk coming, you know, that was out of one of the windshields. And they figured out, now how they figured this out, I don't know, I guess trajectory or orbital mechanics, that it was caused from a speck of paint. And now the shuttle was going at 17,500 miles an hour, and the paint was going in the opposite direction at the same speed, 17,500 miles an hour. So you add that together and you get, you know, some 34,000 mile impact by a speck of paint. The reason it was going in the opposite direction, Israel was at the time interested in putting things into space, and they did. They did a couple of shots, and the problem is they couldn't launch west. They had to launch, correction, they couldn't launch east like everybody else. They had to launch west. They had to go, you know, the other way, over water, in case this thing came down and weren't going to kill anybody. So by doing that, they were actually sent their spacecraft in a retrograde orbit, and that's why you get the 35,000 mile per hour impact with a little tiny speck of paint that put a good bullseye in it inside. I did see a picture of the window. Back to you, Dick.
So Israel had a launch to the west over the Mediterranean to launch over water. The rotation of the Earth near the equator gives you 1,000 miles an hour of orbital speed, so to speak, for free. They were getting negative 1,000 miles an hour, which means they really had to use a launch vehicle with almost an extra 2,000 miles of velocity capability in order to get that into orbit when you launch to the west. That's one heck of a disadvantage. That's a lot of extra energy of launch required. Back to you, Paul.
I know, but I think they wanted to show the people are thinking twice about coming in, you know, coming out of Israel. That we're a space power too, you know, but they had to prove it. I think that's what that was all about, personally. Back to you, Dick.
Got about a minute, Dick.
Yeah, we've come to the end of our fuse, at the end of our rope. This was Technet. Okay. This was Technet number 1523 of the series that began in September of 1982, 32 years ago, this month. Bye-bye, you all. We'll be back next week. And keep those cards and letters going to John, because some of those are very challenging questions. KC2WGB. Go ahead, John. K2RIW. Bye-bye, you all.
You guys getting
KC2WGB. This is KB2CB.
Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Definitely had a good time, and Saturday
my daughter and her roommate and I, and the little dog went on a hike up to the top of St. Regis. She, who must be feared and obeyed, decided not to go. She was not wearing the proper footwear, number one, nor do I think that she would have been fully capable of making it, because it got quite steep at some points. A lot of vertical stuff. So there was some sections where the dog got put in the backpack, and we did what we had to do, and then the dog got taken out of the backpack, because I didn't think the little dog was going to be able to climb up and jump up big rocks. Big rocks. Well, sounds like you had a good time. Must have been gorgeous up there, because if there are still leaves, they should be all golden. They were peak color. I would say they were already peak color. Maybe just a skosh past peak. So it was the perfect time to be up there. Everything was just absolutely beautiful. I took lots of pictures, some of which I think I put up. I got tons more I'll put up this evening, this afternoon, whatever, when I get home. Don't be insulted if I don't comment on them. I'm not on Facebook anymore. Oh, wow. Someday you'll have to tell me all about this. I don't know. All right, well, whatever. Sorry for your troubles. But stop talking about it. Yeah, so tell me more about the weekend. Could have been organized a little bit better, but, you know, it is what it is. But we had a great time. Got to do some things. Got taken to a couple of, you know, the, whatever you want to call it, the local spots on campus where everybody goes to whatever, hang out. There's a place called The Point, which is a little bit of a hike from behind one of the dorms that takes you out to a point on the lake where if you go out there at night, you just, the stars are just absolutely phenomenal. So we went out there Friday night, hung out for a while. There was a big bonfire going on and some s'mores and marshmallows and that kind of stuff. Did some stuff in town, went to dinner. We had a good time. Had fun. She definitely appreciated us bringing the dog. She missed her little doggy. Sounds like it was a wonderful weekend. When you get away from the city and you look up at the sky, you get to see the stars. The lights in the city kind of blank everything out. And where we live is still considered city enough.
Well, on a clear night, you'll still catch some stars. You just won't see all the stars until you get away from the light. I mean, when we were out on the boat years ago, you know, being out on the boat at night on a clear night, you could see a lot more stars because you just had to be away from the light pollution. Ugh. Oh, God. I don't know why I'm yawning. And to be a mobile, by the way. But everything out there that was just perfect. There was a big I don't know what you would call it, exhibition at the Visitors Information Center. They call it the VIC, which is just up the road from the college main entrance. And they had all sorts of stuff going on there, a bit of a farmer's market, craft market, this, that, the other thing. Somebody was
giving away horseshoes, all sorts of other wonderful and cool things, animals and horses and goats and chickens and how to get the most out of slaughtering your pig and stuff like that. Gee, just what I would come in really handy for me. How to get the most out of slaughtering a pig. How to milk a goat. You know, if you want to learn how to milk a goat, hey, we'll teach you how to milk a goat. There's lots of fun stuff. And, we stayed at the same cabins we stayed at last time, so that was pretty cool. Almost felt like home. Yeah, I remember, you know, you usually end up settling into a place that you're comfortable with, good rates, convenient to the school, and anytime you go up, that's where you end up going. But there weren't that many times that we ended up doing the sleepover, because a lot of the times I would just drive down to Delaware, load the car, and drive back and do it in one day, actually, one evening. How many hours is it to where they were? I don't remember the exact amount of time, but I used to leave Manhattan on a Friday night at 4 o'clock, get down to Delaware, load the car, have dinner, drive back, and I'd be home before midnight. It's 6.5 hours with no traffic. With no traffic, it's 6.5 hours. And that's exceeding the speed limit by fair amounts, too. There's just no fast way up there. And yesterday, there was some kind of major traffic jam. Slow down, whatever you want to call it, on the thruway from exit 18 all the way to exit 12. To put that in perspective, that's New Paul's to about the Woodbury Commons after Harriman and all that, you know, Woodbury, like when you just come over the Tappan Zee Bridge. So we had to find a different way home last night. Ouch. The only way I could think of from there is as soon as you come over the Tappan Zee, shoot on 287 and take it to Springbrook and come down that way. That's if you could have gotten that far south. I'm talking you couldn't get south of New Paul's. Oh, real fun. What you do, go over to US 1? The thruway was doing like 4 miles an hour for like that entire stretch. It would rubber band. There was, you know, a little bit of construction, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. There was a broken down bus by mile marker, whatever, 98 to 48 or something like that. I had seen the blinking yellow lights for the highway advisory radio sign, so I tuned to whatever it was, 1710. And I listened to the announcement, and I'm like, this is not good. And then, of course, the traffic receiver for the GPS wasn't getting any signal, so it couldn't do any, you have a delay ahead, reroutes. So we just pulled the ripcord and headed over the Mid-Hudson Bridge, took Route 9 down to 84, took 84 across to 684, 684 down into the Hutch, and took the Hutch down and did the zigzag in the Bronx on Bruckner Boulevard to get onto the Throg's Neck. Well, at least you knew an alternate route. Speaking of routes, I'm up to Franny Loop, by the way. I'm not that far behind you. I'm just at the Jose Cuervo. So it actually, with our original estimate, when we got in the car, saying that we were going to get home at about, I guess, it was 8:45, 8:50, we wound up rolling in at about 9:07. So with all that we did, we actually were saved a great deal of grief, because I guarantee it, we would have lost a